Good evening and welcome to Sunday Showcase. I'm Damiano Pietropaolo. Tonight, we begin Heartbeats, a new series of radio plays exploring matters of the heart. Appropriately enough, our first play in the series is The Domino Heart by Matthew Edison. A young man dies tragically in a car accident, and according to his wishes, his heart is donated for transplant surgery. The play follows the new life of this heart as it touches and changes the lives of those who inherit it. The Domino Heart was produced at the Tarragon Theater as part of its 2002-2003 season and was nominated for the Dora Award for Best Play. Here now, starring Gordon Pinsent, is The Domino Heart.
Love is a chain. Love is a chain. Oh, I try to fly off through the sky, but here I remain.
Yes.
Well,
no use thinking about it.
The irony, of course, is that it was Peter who wanted to get the car with all the supposed safety features. I was pushing for the, you know, I kept saying, I want the cute yellow one with the removable top. I remember thinking there was an opening for a little joke, don't we all, dear, or something. But Pete, we've got to think of Gracie, he said. And it's true. I wasn't. Well, not that our daughter would be. That any of us would be killed in the car we were about to buy. You just don't think of those kinds of things. But he did. Peter did. I remember once, here at the cottage, Peter's parents were visiting. At one point, Linda, Peter's mother, went to bed, and I went upstairs to check on Gracie. Peter and his father were left talking on the porch. I could hear them below the window going on about the family of loons that had nested themselves at the end of the lake. George, Pete's father, got to talking about Linda, and it was really quite sweet to hear how much he was still in love with her. They'd been together, what, nearly 40 years. Anyway, at one point, and somewhat out of the blue, it seemed, he let go this deep sigh and said, I hope she dies before I do. And then Peter, in a sort of tone of understanding, I know. And I couldn't, I mean, what was that about? She wasn't sick or anything. I thought, that's a terrible thing to say. And then for Peter to agree, as if, you know, as if the same could be said for me. Well, but you see, I never understood love the way Peter did. Now, of course, now, but that is true love. I wouldn't wish life on anyone who has lost. Lost because you are as good as dead, but you are not dead. Yours is a death of a different kind, a life of death. It is a life sentence, and you must live it each day with a sort of hopeless Promethean routine. I didn't know that until now, but he knew. He must have thought about it. If I were to have died, or more likely, which brings me back to the car. So, we bought the Volvo, and the irony, the not so comical but nonetheless remarkably ironic thing, was that Gracie, thank God, wasn't in the car. I got out with little more than a few scrapes and bruises, and Peter was the one. Several factors, they tell me. Snow flurries, black ice, a pickup truck with a load of steel pipes, and, oh yes, a deer. The deer stepped in front of the truck hit the deer. Then we hit the back of the truck, which caused the steel pipe to come loose and go through the driver's side windshield and Peter's head. That song was on the... This is what is known as the chain of events, the police tell me. The chain of events that led to my husband being dead. But maybe It started earlier in the evening. Or maybe it began some time ago, because in the car we were arguing. We were in the midst of an important argument which bloomed at that moment but was planted long before we hit the ice that caused us to hit the truck that carried the pipes that killed Peter. We were at a party, a big to-do at the museum. Peter and I were mingling through the room, doing the usual, making more contact with the waiters than the guests, when Peter leaned into me and said, "Who's that?" And he pointed to a young man across the room that smiled and raised his glass when I looked over. "I don't know," I said. Which was a lie, because the young man was a student of mine years ago at the university, and, well, okay. James and I had a very brief but intense affair that, God, it was stupid. A couple of years after Peter and I were married, before Gracie, Peter was on a book tour. James would come into my office after class, ask me questions. He was a smart kid, handsome in a romantic sort of way. I was flattered, I guess. One starts to miss the excitement that comes with something new and unknown. It's not that I didn't think about it. About Peter, I did. I know what I was doing. But I don't know. I wanted to betray myself. The honor student, the wife, the teacher. I wanted to throw it all to the wind. Who I was and everything I'd gained by being that person. I wanted to gamble it all, and I did. I called it off with James the night before Peter returned. He took it better than I'd hoped, really. In fact, James didn't seem to mind. He didn't seem to mind all that much. But there he was, our trouble, back from the dead. I should never have told Peter. But you see, at the time, I was confused. I didn't know that I was still in love with him. And I thought it would give me clarity by telling him. We'll talk it out. Maybe we'll find out his own part in my unhappiness. At the very least, we'll have an open and honest relationship. When Peter came home, he saw me in the living room. He always looked at me like his face lit up, you know, like a sunflower. And it was like a cloud passed between us and everything faded suddenly. It made me shiver. We sat in the kitchen and I told him. I don't know what I expected exactly. Anger, yelling, an argument of some kind. Instead, he was very quiet for a very long time. His tears, they just came down his face. Everything was very still. His eyes were so green. I'd forgotten. I'll say that I love him. And just as I was thinking that, I realized it was true. I love him. And the thought then of what I might lose, it scared me. It terrified me. Oh, God, I thought, I've made a mistake. I've made a terrible mistake, and I can't go back. Why did I tell him? I should never have said a damn word. I put my hand on the table. Peter, I'm sorry. It was stupid. I'm very sorry. What can I do? What do you need? You, he said. You have me, Peter, for God's sake. I'm right here. And he stood up. But I want you to understand how I feel, he said. And he held out his hand. This is my heart. And he squeezed his fist around the blade of a knife and pulled it through his hand. Peter taught me about love. We didn't talk about it much after that. Didn't have to, really. We knew each other pretty well. It could live between us in the quiet. And we moved on, in a way, I suppose. And actually, I think we had some of our happiest times. And I guess I wanted to believe that things were better, but really they weren't. Not really. He was never quite the same person, and he knew it. He was less open, more insecure. And I'd look at him and I'd think, I did that. Yesterday, I've been reading his journals. I found this one page. When you find someone, you give them a little bit of your heart and hope that they return with a little bit of theirs. Slowly, or maybe all at once, you hold it entirely in your hands as an offering, the most vulnerable part of yourself, because you trust that, more than anyone, they will be tender with it. But when they are not, when they are careless, they destroy the very part of you that was born in the moment you first let it go. Never take love for granted. It's the most amateur mistake. So that night at the party with James, whom I hadn't seen since he left for Harvard, Peter figured it out. He knew. "Who's that?" he said. "Where?" "Over there with the glass." "I don't know who that is." We were going to have a weekend together. That was the plan. "We need some time alone together. We'll go up to the cottage after the party. Leave Gracie with your mother." "Peter, the roads," I said. "The cottage isn't even..." "Shh," he said. "Let's just do it." And I was really looking forward to that. But then the silence in the car was so loud, I couldn't... "What, Peter, what?" And he asked me, and I don't know why I resented it, but I did. "Why, Peter, why do you want to know?" "Because I do." "What exactly? If that was him? My fling?" "Yes. Peter, okay, that was him, okay? He was my little shame. Can we move on with our lives now, can we?" And he was silent, and I thought, Christ, what else can I do? This is killing us. I told him he was being selfish. He was keeping me prisoner with guilt. Grow up. There are worse things, for Christ's sake. He said, "I'm sorry." And then we hit the ice and drove into the back of the truck, and the pipe came through the windshield, and that was it. He was gone. In a heartbeat. The truth is, there aren't many things worse than being careless with someone's heart. That is unforgivable. It's just that in this world, we've become used to such cruelties. So you see, maybe the argument was also a factor in the accident. Maybe, I don't know, his lack of concentration, his watery eyes. Maybe, in fact, my affair with that boy so many years ago was the first link in the chain of events that led to Peter's death. Or maybe a deer just crossed the road at the wrong time. You can't... There's no use trying to make sense of things. It's a lesson in futility. It was a little odd sitting here today listening to the service. The minister trying to console us with the peace of mind that might come with the idea of knowing that Peter is in a better place, whatever that is for him. And then Gracie sitting beside me. She's only 7. She looks at me and asks, "Are you okay?" And I squeeze her hand and say, "Yes, are you?" And do you know what she said? This little girl of mine, she said, "I don't think this is about Daddy. I think this is about us. And I believe that if there is a God, he will most likely be a child." She has Peter's heart. Actually, that's not true. The paramedics found Peter's organ donor card with his license. 43, no history of heart disease. He was a prime candidate. At first, I didn't want them to take it. It seemed unfair, insensitive. And then the idea that he might live on, you know, somehow in someone else. I don't know. So I said, okay, if I can see it. I'd like to see it. So that night after the accident, I'm in another room in the hospital. This bereavement counselor is talking to me, and I'm on these antidepressants. The door opens, and this doctor comes in with the paramedic and a beverage cooler. He opens up the cooler, and there it is. Pink. Healthy. Alive. The doctor said, he's going to a good home. And they left, rushing out the door. Urns are beginning to look more and more like thermoses. You have to pay extra if you want your thermos to resemble an urn. They call it a vessel now. They presented me with a catalog of vessels to peruse as if I were in the market for a yacht, as if Peter might sail off at any moment. Your heart's a phoenix, Peter. Did you know that? It's just a... you know, it's just a pump. This hand, Peter, is my heart. I want you to understand how I feel.
Wake up! We've been asleep for too long. Stretch and feel how your souls have atrophied. Rub your eyes and see again. This world is filled with miracles, and our time is short. A good start. I knew I had them. There's an art to writing sermons, and last Sunday's was, if I do say so myself, a doozy. The trick is, I always say this to young ministers, speak as if you're dying, because you are. Wake up. Our time is short. It's now. It's this moment. This one. This one. And I know they're listening, because if you're a good listener, you can hear people listening. Fidgeting, for instance, arises naturally from the discomfort of truth sinking in. The occasional coughs, the creaking of pews, these are good sounds. Like that buzzer that goes off in hockey when a goal is scored. It means the puck's in the net. Look around. And of course, no one does. Wake up. Rub your eyes. Look. They don't know what to look at. What does he want? I want you to see. See what? What? And they look and they don't see. And I know that this world is in trouble. I get the pass, I deep the deacon, I wind up. Each one of us is a prayer heard and answered and wasted. It rockets towards the net with such lightning truth that even Satan leaps from his path. Will he score one for Jesus? Wait for it, wait for it. Cough, fidget. Yes! Hallelujah! Oh. Hallelujah. Should have thought to bring proper writing paper. Hospital stationery isn't the most considerate of... Oh, well. Maybe he has a sense of humor after all. In a few hours, I'm going to get a new heart. The old one's giving out. I like to think it's because I overuse it. It's a waiting game now while they harvest the donor's organ. They don't often call it a heart here in the transplant world. It's the organ. Nancy, the organist at St. Paul's, said, just make sure this one's in tune and try to keep the pipes clean. She likes to remonstrate with me for the years I consumed Bertie's smoked meat sandwiches without heeding a single of her warnings. It's very controversial back home. Or shouldn't a good man of the cloth respect the fate God has handed him? After all, isn't this what I've been waiting for? What, with heaven and eternal paradise awaiting me on the other side? I don't know about that. I have some questions, to be perfectly honest about it. But I like my job. I like raising people's spirits, as it were. I'm good at it. And I get a lot of joy out of it. Nancy likes to tease me. Geez, Mortimer, what do you want to hang around here for? You've had nearly 70 good years with that heart of yours. I said, I know, but I was given a lifetime guarantee. And she said, no, Mort, nobody's given that. It's possible that my body, this church, may not accept the gift of this new organ. So, if it's not to be, heaven and eternal paradise would be a nice runner-up. We'll see. My prayer remains the same. For harmony. I used to manage this volunteer program to help babies who were orphaned. Some of these children suffered from addictions to alcohol and narcotics carried down through the parents. Often the babies would go into these fits. The word withdrawal wasn't even around the corner. Their screams were terrible. They'd cry. Their bodies were all purple and red, and sometimes they would break into seizure. They were a mess. And beyond holding them, there isn't much you can do. But already that is a lot. My job was to find volunteers to come into the basement of this church for a few hours each day and have them hold one of these children. Just sit and hold them. It wasn't easy getting volunteers, and I don't blame them. It isn't a walk in the park. But then, love is not always a walk in the park. If you hold them to your chest, I told my new soldiers of affection, so they can feel your warmth and hear your heartbeat, there's a good chance that they'll survive. The volunteers that went the extra bit and talked to them, stroked hair, kissed cheeks, dramatically improved the child's ability to cope with their afflictions. People that are loved are stronger, healthier, happier people. Full stop. What bothers me is, why do we think we need anything less when we're older? There are people in this world who are starved for love. I don't get it. There's a bottomless resource of the most valuable and powerful commodity in the world, and still there are people going without. Did we deprive ourselves? Why don't we let it in? Okay, we don't like to burden people with our needs, but people want to love. They're waiting for the chance. Why deprive people of the opportunity to... It is what we do best when we're at our best. And we do it naturally. Beautifully. I'm sorry if I sound... I'm a preacher. It's an occupational hazard. When I was a young minister, they used to say to me, don't be a saint, Mortimer. You'll get crucified. I'm scared about tomorrow. I'm not going to lie to you. Not of dying. That's not... Not of dying, but of not living. There are too many people to meet. Books to read. Places to go. Things to learn. That's why I don't sleep. I'm restless. Here it is now, what? Oh, holy moly. 4:30. They'd kill me if they knew I was still up. They tried to give me a pill, a sleeping pill. I told my lovely nurse, Jeanette, I said, Jeanette, my body is God's temple, and I'm afraid that I simply cannot allow that pill to reside in my system. You understand? God bless her lovely, naive, 22-year-old heart. She did. Only in a hospital, where they want you to be well-rested so you can be wide awake for the anesthesiologist to put you back to sleep again. I don't know why I never found someone. Got married. I thought I would. Love really is like winning the lottery. You're ecstatic. All your problems are suddenly made trivial. Your friends hate and envy you. And somehow you can't believe that you got it. You pinch yourself and it's still there. Has there been a mistake? So you test it. You push it to the limit. How real is this love? How true? How strong? Can it survive distance, time, betrayal? But why do we do this? Unless there's something in us that feels we don't deserve it. I feel for the family. The young man whose heart will soon. One of the things I realized holding those babies is that we are born with a fire. This vital fire to live. So that even when hope is extinguished, there's still this spark within us to ignite the dying embers. Love. Mortimer Wright. This is what I've learned. It is not easy to have compassion. Real compassion. Especially for ourselves. It's hard. It's enough just to get out of bed some mornings without the weight of other people's lives to worry about. I can barely pick up the morning paper without some headline or photo of some new atrocity pressing down on me. Compassion isn't easy. Acts of compassion are even harder. So why should we bother? Because we're doomed if we don't. We're doomed. Love is like blood. It's self-rejuvenating. It pours out of us and replenishes itself as it does so. Which might explain why the heart is a muscle. And like any muscle, we have to exercise it, explore its limits. In these times of great weight, we must flex with every ounce of our being. Patience, Mortimer. God hasn't finished with you yet.
Because I'm connected to the system. Veins lead from me, from this office, and branch into a complex network that reaches every part of this comatose world. And then it comes back. This is the heart. I'm in advertising. And the risks are high. And like anything, that's the fun of it. Most of us have heart attacks by the time we're 30. I was 33. Wasn't that the same age Jesus was when he died? Can't remember. Never paid much attention in church. Anyway, it's not important. I belong to a different church now, and I am a true believer. I have seen the light. God isn't dead. He's alive and well. And those of you who don't believe me, who think, oh, he's just being cynical. Well, whatever makes you feel better. I know, I'm sorry, I know, but don't shoot the messenger. Just trust me. The news I bring you is true. It's from the source, the horse's mouth. Hey, don't get me wrong. I count my lucky stars. Every shiny one of them. I mean, I think we realize that in fact. Yes, perhaps, practically, life is better with money than without. But you have to ask yourself this. What kind of life? A word here to those of us at the top. If there's one thing we can learn from our history, it's that the poor will, at some point, rise up and cut our heads off. Yeah, make no mistake, heads will roll, rich and poor. It's just a matter of time. I know this because I've lived in both worlds. My mother, she's Mexican. My, what, daddy? He was a Ukrainian from the south side, a loan officer. He worked at a bank outside the projects where she was staying with her uncle. He's dead now, high blood pressure. I'm not going to go into all the details, but the facts are these. Her uncle would only let her stay with him if she worked and went to school. So she got a job cleaning office toilets and went to apply for a loan at the bank to, you know, for tuition. Well, my daddy would only give it to her if she gave it back to him. Do you understand? You know, with a little wink. So she left the bank. And on the walk home, he pulled over his car and raped her. Well, something like that. I only ever got pieces of the puzzle over the years. And of course, I am one of them. So, not that it was my fault or anything. I used to think she didn't, you know, like me. But I guess we're just different people. But, you know, I'm very successful now, so I'm a divining rod for social need. If it doesn't gush forth from where I did, I manufacture it. This is my area. I'm the global account director for Lucas, Triggs, and Burkhoff. Yeah, you may know of us. You've certainly been exposed to us. We're an advertising firm. Let me tell you something. Growing up in poverty and fatherless, well, let's just say I was a little depressed most of the time. What I did was I ate. I ate a lot. Junk food, anything. I got into drugs. I was huffing glue, you name it. Well, this is what you do when your life is empty. When you're unhappy, you fill it with something else. Even if it's only temporary, it does bring a sort of momentary contentment. I remember looking at my mother one day in the apartment. We were living on welfare. She slept on the couch and watched TV for days on end. We were watching, I don't know, reruns of something retarded, and we just killed the last bag of potato chips. Then this commercial comes on. A bunch of rich kids throwing a house party. It's set up like a beer ad, right? Lots of implied underage sex. And these guys are in the backyard draining the pool. And what do they fill it with? Chips. A giant bowl of chips. Of course, there's two kids off in a corner who are just so in love that they have to share their own bag. I looked from our empty bag on the floor to the one on the TV to my mother lying on the couch. And what I realized was that this world runs on the fuel people like my mother and I provide. This fuel is need. This was quite the epiphany for my 13-year-old brain, and it still holds true. When a company comes to us with a product, we design a campaign telling you why you need this product, and you buy it, and the company pays me based on my reputation to tap into or summon the necessary demand for the product to have a sustainable life. What's really great is that everyone seems to know they're being manipulated, but as we hoped, no one cares. People think they're immune, and we let them think that. This guy who used to have this job, Adam Holstein, he was 52, I was 26. He thought he did everything right? He gave to charities, he did volunteer work, he never fooled around on his wife. You know the guy. Hell, he brought me into this place. If it weren't for him, I'd still be working on the floor. So I get a call from Triggs that Adam's out and I'm in. And on that day in the washroom, I hear him crying. He's cleared out his desk, and I see his box at the bottom of the stall. I say, Adam, you okay? You know, he did a lot for me. I don't want the guy to go jumping through a window or anything. Anyway, he comes back with, go screw yourself, Juarez. That's me. Come on, Adam, be a man, for Christ's sake. And I guess he didn't like that so much. He charged out of the stall, grabbed me by the throat, started yelling all kinds of crap. He was sweating, and his face and eyes are all red, and people were coming in and calling for security, and that's when it occurs to me. He actually expected there to be some kind of equilibrium in the world where people, good and bad, got what they deserved. And he felt he deserved some good, of course. But what could I tell him? This is a fisherman caught on his own line. Adam's squirming on the bathroom floor. He's struggling to get up and fight. It's embarrassing. His own friends holding him down, the looks on their faces like, where the hell did this come from? He was always so nice. But I mean, really, like, I had to ask, why do you think you deserve better? Because you've been a good boy? That does not mean a shoe shiner's fart in the world of things. I mean, how could you work a day in your life in this business and honestly believe that shit? I asked him, seriously, do yourself a favor and stop walking around with these expectations of what you deserve. Like you alone have drawn the short friggin' straw or something. Grow up. Be a man. This is the world you live in. And then I washed my hands when I left, and honestly, I think that was the best thing anyone could have told him. The mystery of where we are headed is only a mystery to those who still believe there's someone at the wheel. The rest of us have either submitted to the voyage or jumped ship. Or, as in Adam's case, and undoubtedly my own, slipped and now just bob mercilessly in life's, salty wake. Hey, I don't pretend to have it all figured out. I just do. It's why I'm successful at my job. I paint a picture of the world people think they want to see, and then they walk into it and accept it as one they've created themselves. But it's all illusion. It's sleight of hand. It's a lie. The two things people notice most when they don't have them are love and money. But you see, the thing is, money is tangible, okay? You can get it. If you have a knife, you can get money. If you're clever, you can acquire it, okay? But nothing you have. Not even money. Do you see what I'm saying? All the tea in China will not guarantee you the other. Look, you can't escape it. You have to buy this crap, and really, you've got other things to worry about. So why do I care? Well, I don't like this world. I have a very clear view of its workings, and from up here, it resembles something not unlike a dead... I'm dead. I don't. My mother. I don't understand my mother. I suppose that's not uncommon. The thing is, I've spent my life trying to every cent. You know, I don't even own a everything, all the money. Do you understand? Everything for her. I'm in the hospital about to go into surgery, and she walks in. She's wearing the same goddamn sweater she's worn for 20 years, because after all, what would it, you know, all of this have been for, if not, I mean, you know, I've worked hard. I've worked very, very hard to succeed in this game, so just, you know, a coat, something. Thank you. You're forgiven. You've been a good son, Leo. You're a good person. But I'm not, really. I should tell you that I hoped I would be wrong. That string would not be pulled simply because I could afford to have them pulled. But I wasn't wrong. And now, here I am with a new life, and I feel I should tell you. Smoking, drinking, uppers, downers, salty foods, MSG, you name it. I'm supposed to be taking these immunosuppressive drugs, but, well, sometimes I wait. I know. I'm what? Undeserving? Yeah, you're right, but I think it proves a point, don't you? You see, I'm a valued resource at the firm. To lose me is to lose money. I'm attached to a number of big accounts. If I go, they go. So, I'm in my room, watching a movie. I get a call from Warren Ainsley, the firm's legal associate. I'm not to worry, he says. There's a clinic near the Canadian border. We're taking care of it. And I said, innocently, what about the waiting lists? Don't worry, Leo. You'll be back on your feet in 6 weeks. 3 days later, I'm on a table in prep for a domino transplant operation. Is this the world we live in? I ask myself. Well, it turns out, yes, it is. The Lord taketh, and the Lord giveth back again. Where's the sense in anything? Where's the sense that someone like me should get this heart? Can someone please explain this to me? Can someone please explain why my mother is raped at 17 and gives birth to this unhappiness? She'll never say it, of course, but I know. After the operation, I'm lying in the bed. Then I feel my mother holding my hand, squeezing it. I know it's her, the dry skin, the calluses. And these thoughts are running through my head. I'm sorry, forgive me, but for what? I want to say that I love her. She leans over and kisses me on the forehead. Her tears fall on my face, roll down my neck into the pillow, I squeeze her hand. She looks at me. And then I see it. My face in her eyes, staring back at me. And there, just behind that reflected face, I see this little hole of resentment. And I know that I can never fill it. I will never fill it. How are you feeling? She asks me. Like $1 million, I tell her. Like $1 million. Things are easier thought than said, and easier said than done, but I am in the business of thought power, and I want you to know that the people you buy from do not care about you, or the health or education of your kids, or the environment, or inner city violence, or the third world, because they are not designed to care. They are designed to make money. This is nothing new, but to make money, we need your trust. And we are lying to you to get it. A lot of people with power do not want a better world. They want a tin can with legs and arms that can be emptied and filled and emptied and filled and emptied until the soul is rusted out. And if it makes you feel better to tell yourself that I'm just being cynical, then you tell yourself that if it makes you feel better. But I know this world. I've got my finger on the pulse, and it's racing. Don't be fooled. Trust me. It's from the source, the horse's mouth.
Today is the first day of spring. It is also the first day of the rest of my life, I'm told. They're sending me home today from the hospital. I love the smell of spring. The air seems crisper, sweeter. The flowers blooming, I suppose, but more than that, there's the smell of newness, don't you think? Of possibilities. I used to get very creative around this time of year, waking from hibernation. I needed to stretch after a long sleep. I'd have this rekindled urge to paint or write poetry. I'd drive to Loomis and Toll's to buy large frames of canvas, tubes of cadmium red and cerulean blue, slopping it on. I didn't care, whatever felt right. I loved it when I was younger. I don't know why. Trees. I used to paint a lot of trees. I took some pills. I took a lot of pills and chased them with half a bottle of vodka 3 days ago. I shouldn't have loved him so much. I'd hurt less. It humiliates me to be that woman. That woman who's so dependent that her life means so little without her man. What is this? I kept asking myself. How did I get so lost? I was someone before he came along. Who was I? I'm still her, but I've been changed. He changed me. I'm someone else now, and I can't ever go back. I couldn't stop crying. My eyes were swollen. My face was raw from the salt and the rubbing. Find strength. Be stronger than this, Kara. But how? I'm empty. Something from nothing? How do you do it? And of course there's a lot to be thankful for, but you're blinded. You don't see that. You think of all the things, your family, your friends, a little girl who needs you, but you're overwhelmed by a tide of numbness, and it washes over everything. You look back and everything's vanished, carried away, just floating debris. You see the ruins of where your life was built, and you remember that just a moment ago it stood there, monumental, as if nothing could touch it. Now, gone. I undertook to track down the man who had received Peter's heart. Maybe I was looking for closure, I don't know. Anyhow, he died. Something during the operation. It's not easy to find the right heart. There has to be a perfect match or the body rejects it. But Peter's heart was still vital. She said it was cleared for a domino transplant procedure. I said, "What's that?" She said, "I'm sorry, I have to go." I don't know why I can't move on like other people. Inadequate coping skills, I'm told. So I tried to find this other person, but I couldn't. And I began to feel very lonely, listening to a therapist explain to me over the phone why it was uncharitable of me to be disappointed about not locating the individual whose life was sustained by my dead husband. But they got what they want. They got a second chance. What about me? I just wanted to hold them, to tell them about Peter. We're connected by him. The university gave me a leave of absence after the accident. My mother moved in to help. I was a wreck. I did see a bereavement specialist. I took medication. I couldn't do it anymore. I tried very hard, but I guess I was just very tired. I wanted to sleep. You know? So I drove to the cottage. I put on a piano concerto by Ravel, dashed off a note for my lawyer, and one for Gracie, and I embraced the pills. I know it was stupid and selfish, but really I just couldn't think of anything but sleep. I remember a moment of consciousness in the ambulance, and then they tell me I fell into a coma for 4 days. So I guess, in a way, I did get some sleep. I remember when I was pregnant with Gracie, and those nights you pray your baby will be healthy and there won't be any complications. But life is complicated. Sometimes it feels as if, with all this new technology and everyone trying to uncover the secrets, that there's nothing left to wonder at. But life, death, love, it's comforting not to know everything. There's this booklet here in the hospital about corrective eye surgery. It says that patients who have been blind since birth and have the surgery often fall into deep depressions following the operation. For the first time, they see and understand what society considers beautiful, and it scares them. They see themselves reflected in a mirror, and they fear that they are not what other people want or like. So apparently they walk around with their eyes shut, reverting to the world of the blind and the familiar. I think that's what I was doing before, well, the pills. Now I must force myself to look. I've woken up with new life and new eyes, and I have to learn to see again, to live again. I was thinking about this, about my daughter, and how our lives are just in front of us. If I could find the strength to accept it. And to be honest, I didn't think that I would be able to do it. They say about people who've survived suicide attempts that there is a moment after you've, whatever, jumped from the ledge, a moment where it's too late and you can't go back. And in that moment, they say, most of us have changed our minds. I can't say that I actually had that moment, but I very much have it now. I count my lucky stars. My daughter Gracie and Reverend Mortimer Wright. He left me this letter on his bedside table in his hospital room. It was addressed to the donor's family should he die during the operation. I received it here the day I woke up from my coma more than 3 months after he wrote it. I'm not one to leap to mythical explanations for things, but you have to admit, that's a little spooky. Then I open the letter, and it's as if... I don't know how else to say this. It was as if God were speaking to me. I know he was in the business, but I don't mean like that. It was as if he was saying the very things I needed to hear in order to have the strength to lift myself out of bed. It was as though he were there in the room with me, and I just wept. Hello, my name is Mortimer Wright. If there is a window in the room where you are reading this and you feel up to it, I recommend pulling the curtains aside and letting the air in. Even plants need a...
Even plants need a bit of light. And you can't read in the dark. I want you to know, first of all, that I love you.
And now I must believe in miracles. I miss Peter. I miss him. It's frightening to feel how much someone has grown inside you. How much of yourself is held together with the glue of other people. I feel better, but there's still a lot of reconstructive work to do. It's only natural after a part of you has fallen away. Not all of me. Just a very lovely part that I'll miss. Peter was answering questions from an interviewer on the radio, and I guess the interviewer had imagined these questions were difficult on the subjects of life and death. And Peter, you know, he was very smart. At one point, the interviewer said, kind of jokingly, "All right then, Mr. Fortree, what do you think is the answer to the universe?" You know, with a little A smartass. But Peter took the question very seriously and answered simply, "Balance. Balance. Of course." I feel like the first sprout breaking through cold earth and reaching for the sun, for warmth, for home. There are trees in Peru called walking palms. They look like arms with fingers of the hand sunk slightly into the earth. These fingers are the roots, and I like to imagine that as the sun moves across the sky, the roots lift up one by one and walk the tree towards the light. I think Gracie and I would take a trip to Peru if she wants. Paint the trees, talk, laugh, count some stars. After all, our life is this moment. This one, gone, in a heartbeat.
On Sunday Showcase, you've just heard The Domino Heart by Matthew Edison. In the cast, you heard Gordon Pinsent as Reverend Mortimer Wright, Brenda Robbins as Kara, and Sean Doyle as Leo Juarez. The recording engineer was Wayne Richards, with sound effects by Anton Zabel. The script editor was Dave Carley, and casting was by Linda Grierson. The associate producer was Colleen Woods. Associate producer for Sunday Showcase is Rosie Fernandez. The Domino Heart was produced and directed in Toronto by Linda Grierson. If you would like to send us a letter, please address it to Sunday Showcase, Box 500, Station A, Toronto, M5W1E6. And send emails to sunshowcase@cbc.ca. That's it for tonight. Just a reminder that this program will be aired again tomorrow night on Monday Night Playhouse at 9.05 p.m. on CBC Radio 2. And don't forget to join us again next week for Tansy's Brag, a comedy about the travails of the heart of Tansy, a Jesuit priest and teacher. For Sunday Showcase, I'm executive producer Damiano Pietropaolo. Stay with us now for Katie Malick and Jazz Beat on CBC Radio 1. Good night.